See you tomorrow.
It is officially on, and I couldn't be more excited. I know that sounds weird when you're talking about a retrial, but we are talking about Karen Reed, my friends. And don't think for a minute that Karen Reed's retrial is going to be a redux of trial number one. It ain't. There are a lot of differences. And you know what? We decided to go back and pick up all the ammo each side has against each other so that we could lay it all out for you. Because starting next week, this lady's fate could end up jail, okay? It's as serious as it gets. But her case, also very strong, like freakishly strong. Our Caitlin Becker spoke with her today. You're going to hear about that. Joe Tacopina, who I absolutely adore, he's going to weigh in as well, especially when it comes to talking before you go to trial, because Karen did a lot of it, and it may come back to bite her in the you-know-where. We'll talk about that in a minute. Also, Lori Vallow. Oh, dear Lordy. Another rule. When I say don't talk before trial, how about don't talk during trial? As in, don't talk as your own lawyer. Because this lady seems to think she's smarter than everybody else in the room. Acting as her own lawyer, there's been mistake after mistake after mistake, and she messed it up again today. Just resting her case. That didn't even get done. Because she wants to reserve the right to sleep on it over the weekend to maybe, please, dear God, say yes, examine herself on the stand. Can you imagine what it would be like if she decides to take the stand and as her own lawyer has to ask herself questions? Oh, please let it happen just for the television aspect of it, not for her defense. Because I think we all know where I stand on that. So you're going to hear about that today. But then there's a guy who's going to join me, who I have been trying for 5 years to like wrest information from. But as the lead investigator in Lori's other murders, he wasn't allowed to talk to me, and he was really good at staying quiet. But tonight he gets to open the floodgates and tell me all sorts of secrets that he wasn't allowed to talk about before. I cannot wait for you to hear from this person. That's coming up ahead. And then also, absolutely heart-stopping video that, first of all, left me floored, but then left me very, very angry. Take a look at this. It's a cop. Yeah, cop versus ATV. Look how tough. He's just trying everything to stop this bad guy. And what does the bad guy do? Pops a wheelie, rams him, and takes off. So the bad news is that guy is still on the run. But tonight I'm going to tell you about this manhunt. P.S. I want to join it. I'm that angry when I see something like that. And then I'm also going to update you on the cop's condition. All that is just ahead, but let's start here. Only in my business, the true crime business. Can a rerun be better than the original? And for proof, I submit to you the blockbuster retrial of Karen Reed. It is officially on because jury selection is wrapped and opening statements are scheduled. So block out your calendar for Tuesday. There are a lot of sames that will crop up in next week's trial. Same charges, same judge, even the same courtroom will be featured this time as we saw last time. And of course, the same victim, John O'Keefe. He was a Boston police officer, found dead, frozen in the snow, outside of a house full of cops in January of 2022. Karen Reed was his girlfriend and his ride. She had dropped him off at that house party alive. But what happened after that is what these trials, plural, are all about. Prosecutors say Reed put her SUV in reverse and gunned it right into John O'Keefe before driving off and leaving him to die in the snow. Karen Reed says her boyfriend was killed inside that house party and that she is being set up to take the fall. Her first jury could not decide, and they deadlocked on two of the counts against her. So why am I so convinced the second trial is going to be different? Well, for one thing, a juror from trial number one is now part of trial number two, as her defense team, which in itself blows my mind, but that juror also happens to be a lawyer, so what a fit. There is also a new prosecutor on deck, and the new jury is apparently going to hear from Karen Reed herself this time, whether she takes the stand or not, and I'm going to get to that in a hot minute. But first, what does the Commonwealth have on Karen Reed? And what ammo does Karen Reed have to fend off their attacks? Well, let's start there with Karen Reed's case. So the victim's injuries, they're odd. To say the very least, they are odd. One expert says they don't even match a car accident at all. Another says marks on John O'Keefe's arms look like dog scratches and bites. And yes, the owner of the home where John O'Keefe died did indeed have a German Shepherd, a dog that the owner of the home, Brian Albert, curiously gave away just a few months later, rehomed Chloe the dog. The defense also points to a federal agent named Brian Higgins, who was at that party that night. But Brian Higgins had been secretly trading flirty texts with Karen Reed right before Karen Reed's boyfriend died. Motive? You decide. And then after that boyfriend died, Agent Higgins destroyed his phone and his SIM card, and for good measure, dumped that phone on a military base. Curious place to get rid of your phone. And speaking of phones, about 2 o'clock in the morning, almost 2 hours after Karen Reed dropped John O'Keefe off at that party, Higgins and Albert called each other back and forth. That federal agent who was sexting and the owner of the home called each other back and forth. But when the police asked about those calls, police asking police about those calls, they said they just accidentally butt dialed. Speaking of butt dialing was apparently an epidemic that night, because another partygoer named Jen McCabe called the victim's phone repeatedely around the same time, 2 a.m., long after Karen Reed had already dropped him off. And her call, her answer as to why she called repeatedly to the victim? Butt dials. Butt dials. 2 a.m. butt dials. Rampant. Karen Reed says those were not butt dials. Karen suggests that those calls were an attempt to find the victim's phone, dial it, listen for it ringing, and then cover their tracks. And then there's also Jen McCabe's Googling. Quote unquote, how long to die in the cold? It's misspelled, it's Hoslong, but how long to die in the cold? A search that was initiated at 2:27 a.m. Again, long after Karen Reed had dropped that boyfriend off at the party. And hanging over it all, the lead investigator himself, Massachusetts State Trooper Michael Proctor, former, because he was fired for sending vile, misogynistic texts about Karen Reed just hours into this investigation. So that is Karen's case. What about the Commonwealth's case? What do the prosecutors have on her? Well, we know that they have John O'Keefe's hair and DNA, which allegedly clung to Karen Reed's bumper, even in a blinding snowstorm, and pieces of her taillight, they say they found in the snow near the victim's body. Though they sure did have trouble finding those bright red pieces in the snow, because it took hours and days for them to actually get all those pieces. And there are plenty of excuses as to why Karen Reed's taillight might be broken that would be other than hitting someone. And now there's another potential game changer for the state. Karen Reed's own words. Karen Reed's done a lot of interviews, even a docuseries. The prosecutors say those words can and will be used against her. 44 clips worth. We don't know exactly which clips they plan to play in court, but some of them may come from that new investigation discovery docuseries called A Body in the Snow.
I remember everything. I said, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? And I'm not as clear as I would be if I hadn't been drinking. I mean, I had drank, so, and that led me to question, like, could I have hit him? Did I run over his foot or hit him in the knee? Did I incapacitate him?
Well, those are questions that are pretty intriguing for a jury, especially if you're not even sure. Because back then, you should have been sure, because now you seem to be sure. So how does Karen Reed herself feel about those clips coming into the case?
How do you feel about Hank Brennan planning to use your interviews in his opening statement?
Come at me.
Because we're your dad.
I sound like your dad.
I may have seen it. I would not have said anything that I wouldn't say again.
Today, both sides were back in court for a final hearing on evidence and witnesses, and our national correspondent, Caitlin Becker, was at the courthouse in Dedham, Massachusetts for all of it. She even spoke with Karen Reed today. That's the first thing I want to ask you is, what did you ask her and what did she say, Caitlin?
You know, Ashley, Karen is always really good about talking to the media outside of the courtroom. She sets everyone up. She knows where they're going to be, and she makes it a point to communicate with us. And going into this a second time around, I wanted to know from her perspective how she was feeling, where her mindset was for round two. Take a listen.
Do you feel different this time around versus last time?
I feel a little more tired, but I feel strong. I feel stronger every day. It's just that the scar tissue grows back thick.
You know, Ashley, what was interesting about her response there is that Karen always puts on a pretty happy face on her way into court. She's really as jovial as you can be, considering the circumstances. But her answer to me seemed very real, that going into this a second time, she's more tired. She seemed a little exhausted, but was trying to keep a strong face and a stiff upper lip heading into this again.
I'd be exhausted if I were fighting, murder for a second time round. That's for sure. So, Caitlin, this investigation docuseries that's airing on Hulu, it's a great watch for anybody who wants a full primer on what's about to happen in court. But 44 files are going to be introduced. Potentially, who knows how many of them will be used in court? But 44 clips of interviews that Karen Reed has given, and I am assuming many of them from that docuseries. Do we have any idea which ones and what things might come back to haunt her?
We don't know exactly which ones, but as you said, she has spoken to the media a lot of times. That docuseries, of course, looms large because it is so recent and so comprehensive from Karen herself. But the defense team said that it was at least 44 clips that were handed over as potential options for the prosecution to learn. What we do know is that a 15-second clip of something that Karen has said in public will be used in opening statements on Tuesday. So the jury will hear from Karen Reed in her own words, despite the fact that she may or may not testify. Now, Karen's team also has heard that clip. They are aware of what the clip is, but when we asked her outside of court if she could share what exactly it was, she said that she couldn't tell us. It actually sounded like she wanted to, but she did defer to her attorneys to make sure that she couldn't actually share that with us. So we'll have to wait and see opening statements, what they will use. But it's interesting that she does, of course, have the option to testify in her own defense. She may or may not do that. But because she has been so public, the prosecution has the opportunity to craft her testimony in a way to fit their own narrative, because they can pull bits and pieces out of things that she said and make it work for them.
Boy, can they ever. It's why lawyers will always tell their clients, don't talk to the press. But this is a different kind of case. There's a lot of public support for Karen Reed, and a jury pool might have been the kind of thing they needed to reach. So really interesting. I think in that opening statement, I'm going to just lay odds here, Caitlin. In that opening statement, they will pull the part where Karen Reed says, I'm doing this because I don't want to testify. I don't want to testify. I want to do this. And then a prosecutor can say, why doesn't she want to testify? Is it because you're under oath and you're not allowed to lie under oath, but you can lie to the press? I mean, that would be pretty powerful. I'm just spitballing here. Real quickly, one other thing I thought was a bit weird. There was an argument today, prosecution asking for an independent text message reader. What was that about?
Yeah, prosecution wanted to, and the judge even suggested potentially a male and a female who have nothing to do with the case, really no skin in the game, to come in and read text messages between John O'Keefe, the victim here, and Karen Reed, his then girlfriend, who was, of course, on trial for his murder. The defense was furious. They thought that this would be too theatrical. You're basically bringing in two people to play the parts of the two most important key players in this trial, and that the person who should read the text was the person who read them last time, the trooper trooper who discovered the phone and went through them. That's what the defense says should happen. However, the judge didn't rule on this just yet and did seem to kind of side with the prosecution, suggesting that the whole purpose of bringing in these two random people would be so no one was adding their own inflection or tone. But the defense thinks that he hears the same argument and says it's exactly the opposite. If you bring in two people to play the parts, that it just, it's not going to go over well and it could prejudice the jury.
Well, Trooper Michael Proctor did lose his job over all of this, so if they have to bring him in to read those texts, the defense will have a field day pushing the narrative that these cops are dirty and maybe pushing someone closer to thinking it's reasonable to imagine they might be involved in a conspiracy, which is what Karen Reed wants. Hey, great work again. Thank you, Caitlin Becker. I so appreciate it. And thank you for being on my podcast, too. We went over this whole scenario for an hour, which is airing tonight. We're dropping it tonight. Thanks, Caitlin. Okay, now I want to bring in Joe Tacopina, who is a longtime defense attorney, good friend of the show, and somebody who knows his way around a courtroom. I loved this expression, Joe, that Karen Reed gave to everybody, come at me, when we all found out that 44 clips of Karen's own words are going to come into the trial. She seems to have no issue with it, but lawyers think differently than clients. What's your read on that?
It's a nightmare. I mean, it's just a nightmare. Alan Jackson's a great lawyer, and I think he's going to do a great job here. But he is dying. I'm telling you right now, he's dying over this because, you know, the last thing you want is to have fodder for the prosecution to go at your client with, especially if they're not going to take the stand. She is laid up for the prosecution a bunch of you know, softballs to hit out of the park. I just, some of the clips I saw already, including the one, Ashley, you just referenced, that's a huge one. I'm doing this so I don't have to testify because I don't want to testify. Oh, yeah, it's easy to sit in front of a TV camera and give your side of the story without being cross-examined in front of a jury. Real easy to do that, but she won't testify. It almost forces her hand to have to get up on that witness stand. Then that little line that she said about, I was so intoxicated, I don't remember, I may have hit him. I mean, just, I don't really know for sure. She knows for sure now she didn't hit him. That reeks of fabrication. And so this is what happens when you go out there and give multiple statements when you don't have to. These were not compelled statements. This was her doing her thing. Now, look, she's got a wealth of support out there. Obviously, you know, there's a great group of supporters out there, and this should be. I understand. This case is larded with reasonable doubt, Ashley. It's larded with reasonable doubt. But you just made yourself a much bigger problem than you had to have by doing this. I mean, this was really uncalled for, and it really does give the prosecution, this prosecutor, the new prosecutor, is a special prosecutor, is a defense attorney, which means he actually knows how to cross-examine, knows how to try cases, and is going to use this stuff to his advantage. It's devastating to the defense. Don't let her.
Let me ask you this though.
Come on. They're going to come at her. Don't worry.
This one is different, right? This case is certainly different than a lot of the cases that we've seen. It's so high profile. There's this crazy crowd outside screaming and yelling so loud that the judge had to move the buffer zone back because last time the jurors could hear the screaming during deliberations. Let's do the weighted scale here. Is it worth it for Karen Reed to have done the documentary? Because my assumption is that she got the go-ahead from Alan Jackson to do it. She would not have done anything crazy on her own like that. Would it have been worth it to do that, to get her message out there to the entire jury pool, versus the disaster that it is, knowing full well those words could and would come back into court?
I don't think so, because, you know, you're going to get a jury of 12 now. We're going to decide her fate, and the judge is going to tell them whatever you put outside of court, it doesn't matter. And look, we're all human beings.
You can't unring that bell.
You can't unring the bell. But you're going to be in a courtroom now, and jurors, I find, take this stuff seriously. They take it seriously when they're in the well of a court, and they're debating, you know, whether someone is going to jail or not, or there's a victim, and someone needs justice or doesn't get justice, whatever. But so I think they take it seriously. So now they're going to hear. If any of these jurors have been so persuaded by these documentaries that they're so biased for Karen, I don't think they're going to be on this jury unless they're stealth jurors, unless they're jurors who are completely dishonest jurors who are, you know, just saying I don't have an opinion one way or another, but they really do have an opinion. So the jurors who actually make it onto the jury, assuming they're being honest, are the ones who haven't formed an opinion so strongly one way or another. So the documentaries haven't really done much, but what it has done is given the prosecution enormous ammunition. They didn't have this in the first trial. They don't have Karen Reed saying, I don't want to testify. I'll give statements without cross-examination. Don't cross-examine me. What does that say? That says, I'm afraid of the truth. They don't have her saying in the first trial, yeah, okay, I was so drunk, I may have hit him. I don't know if I hit him or not. That's horrible. I still think this case is a good case for the defense, Ashley. Don't get me wrong.
I was just going to say, I love the fact that you're never allowed as lawyers to point out the fact that someone doesn't want to testify, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. What does that tell you? You're not allowed to say that. Oof. But she's saying especially it the for them. So, yeah, I the hear defense. You. You have to come back. You have to come back and talk about this because it's getting underway on Tuesday. Can we book you again to do play-by-play?
Whenever you want, because this is a reasonable doubt case. And when you're talking about a reasonable doubt case, there's probably not a better one than this one. There are so many reasonable doubts in this case. And that's why no matter what she has done to herself to weaken her case, they're going to be okay.
I love how you think. And I want to start doing a segment about what watch you're wearing. Because there's a lot going on. The media,
I've heard about that,
all the bloggers and the internet are going bananas over whatever. What's the watch tonight? What is it?
Swatch.
Swatch. Oh, my goodness.
Leave me alone. It's late. I'm on trial right now. It's just whatever.
Leave me alone. I love it. Joe Tacopina, thank you. I'll leave you alone right now. I appreciate it. Coming up next, another moment. Another moment of crazy in the murder case against Lori Vallow in Arizona. Representing herself, she seems to struggle even with resting her own case. But no matter, because I just snagged an interview with the lead detective in her first murder trial, and he is finally allowed to reveal secrets that he couldn't tell me back then. He is live with me next. Ought to be music to the ears of a doomsday cult mom. The end is near. Sadly, I don't mean the end of the world for her sake, but I do mean the end of her trial, Lori Vallow's murder trial in Arizona. She is accused of plotting with her late brother to kill her fourth husband. And today the prosecution rested. And Lori Vallow, representing Lori Vallow, she tried to rest too, but she messed it up. She told the judge that she doesn't plan to call any witnesses, but wants the weekend to decide if she'll testify herself on Monday. But that is when closing arguments were scheduled. And oh, what a spectacle it would be if Lori gets to stand up on the dais and swear in and sit down and ask herself questions. Right? Oh, this judge, he's got the patience of a saint. Anyway, Monday, we'll find out. So she didn't rest. She wanted to rest, didn't rest, hasn't rested. That's going to happen Monday. But please, God, please, please take the stand and ask yourself questions. Whether she does that or whether she doesn't do it, and whatever the jury decides in this case, Lori is still going to die in prison in Idaho for the murders of her two children and her current fifth husband's late wife, right? Get the wife out of the way and marry him. That's what she did. And that brings me to my next guest, a guy that I pestered more often than I should have 5 years ago when Idaho was building its case against Lori. Back then, he was Lieutenant Ron Ball, the lead investigator on the case, and the toughest nut to crack. He wouldn't tell me a dang thing. But today, he is Sheriff of Madison County, Ron Ball, in Idaho, and he's allowed to spill some secrets that he couldn't spill before. Okay, Sheriff, it is good to talk to you officially now. And I can't believe you made me wait 5 years, but thank you for being on the show right now.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Okay, so let's talk about first what it's like, because you were down in Arizona. You're watching Lori Vallow getting up and wandering around the courtroom and speaking her mind, when in Idaho, she sat mute. Never testified, never said a word except for the one word answer she had to give the judge. What's your impression of the Lori Vallow you're seeing in Arizona?
Well, I think that it's just really no surprise to anybody. She's not, I don't think she's doing that well. But Lori tends to just have to have things her way, I think. And she wants people to hear her story. And so in Idaho, she never got really to tell her story, because I think during that trial, her attorneys had her best interest. And she didn't really get to say anything until sentencing. And you probably recall that sentencing was quite interesting. And now she's in Arizona. She's chosen to be her own attorney. So she gets to give the details that she wants. You know, she gets to tell the story how she wants to tell it. I'm extremely interested to see how she closes this thing out, whether or not she does testify or, you know, her closing statement.
Yeah, like I said, please God, for the television sake of it, I want to see it. For her defense, terrible idea. Can we talk about the day that her fifth husband, current husband, Chad Daybell, co-defendant and also convicted of the triple murder and on death row, the day that Chad Daybell was arrested and you were there at his house, you all showed up with warrants looking for the bodies of these two children of Lori's, JJ and Tylee. Can you tell me some of the secrets you're allowed to tell now that you were not allowed to tell anybody before?
I don't know if there's a whole lot of secrets. I mean, we've had now two trials on involving that search that day. There is one thing that hasn't got to be mentioned is when we were on that property searching, and right after we found JJ in his grave, Chad left. He'd been across the street at his daughter's house. He got in his vehicle, was driving down the road. And so patrol officers or surveillance officers we had at that time watching him, pulled him over. And myself and Detective Ray Hermosillo, also lead on this case. We went there to where he was stopped. And I had the opportunity to go up and talk to Chad. And I said, Chad, you're being detained right now. We found JJ, and I think we're going to find Tylee. And he was shaking his head in the affirmative. And I said, I know you came from your daughter's house. Is there anything that you want me to go back and tell him? And this comment from him struck me odd, because he said, I've already told them that I'd probably be going to jail today. And it was kind of an eye-opener for me at that time, because it's really the first time he's said anything about that. It was almost a confession. It's probably the closest we had to any type of confession from Chad. So at that point in time, you know, we knew that he knew that it was just a matter of time, and that he was on the clock and his freedom was on the clock, because he knew what was going on. He knew what we were going to find on the property that day.
Yeah, I'll bet. Amazing. So what I'd never heard, and I don't think anybody's heard before, is that you said, we found JJ and I think we're going to find Tylee, and he nodded in the affirmative as though he knew. That's remarkable. And that he said, yeah, my kid, better tell my daughter that I'm going to be going to jail today. Why didn't that make it into court? Why didn't that end up in the trial?
I'm sorry, Ashley. Maybe I better correct myself. I asked if he wanted me to go back and tell his daughter what was going on, and he says, I've already told them, because there's multiple kids over there, I told them I would be going to jail today. So at that point, he knew why we were there, and he knew it was just a matter of time.
And real quickly, why didn't that make it into court? Why wasn't that allowed into court, that statement, which is so close to a confession?
Because at that time, we also knew that Chad had an attorney. So anything that he would have said was attorney client privilege.
Sure. And so yeah, Fifth Amendment. You invoke your right to an attorney, and everything after that isn't allowed in. So that's quite clever on his part. But God bless you for finally telling me that.
Yeah, it was just one of them moments of many moments through this whole case. I mean, this is a case that's gone on for years, and I was counting how many detectives or investigators we had on this case. It just carried on for so long, and it was quite an astonishing investigation. I think with so many agencies and so many people involved, you have to give credit to the agencies involved how well we got along, because we all had one goal, and that goal was to bring justice not just to the kids, but to everybody. And we, even the small part we may have even played in what's going on in Arizona right now.
Yeah, well, listen, Sheriff Ron Ball, it's really good to talk to you. I think I've never had more conversations with a source about snow machines than the actual case itself, because I couldn't get you to say anything back then. But thanks for being on tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ashley.
You take care of yourself up there. All right, coming up next, it is not often that a guest on this show ends up being the subject of this show, but that is where we are with Angie Solomon. Angie's being accused of hiring a hitman to kill her husband, the same husband that she accused on this show of killing their son. It is a complicated web with 500,000 reasons they may not let her out of jail. And that story's next. But if you get it in your head to hire a hitman, don't. For so many reasons. One of which is that that hired gun you're spilling your guts to more than likely is a cop. Almost guaranteed. That's allegedly why a former Tennessee news anchor named Aaron Solomon is still alive and kicking tonight. And why his ex-wife Angie Solomon is sitting in jail. Police say that Angie had it in for Aaron for a long time and that she told her quote-unquote hitman that her ex-husband's death would open up access to a trust fund for their daughter. But Angie was telling a whole other story to me on this show just a year ago, February, when she appeared live. Back then, she was accusing her ex-husband, Aaron, of a bizarre killing. The couple's own son, who died when his own SUV mysteriously rolled over him. Back in 2020, Angie said that Aaron had something to do with it. He was never charged with anything, but I know it is a lot to take in. Thankfully, reporter Audrey Franklin from our Nashville affiliate, WKRN, has the backstory.
According to Franklin police, Angelia Solomon offered an undercover officer money and her car as collateral, giving the officer a list of places Aaron might be in exchange for Aaron Solomon to, quote, disappear and to be put underground. Now Angelia is in jail on a $500,000 bond.
That's the question, is who is Aaron Solomon? Who is he really?
Angelia spoke with News Nation 1 year ago, accusing her ex-husband of killing their son Grant in 2020. Grant's death was ruled an accident after he was run over by his own car. The Sumner County DA has said there was no criminal act in Grant's death.
From my personal experiences with my father and witnessing how he treated my brother, it is very reasonable for him to be responsible for the death of my brother.
3 years ago, the Solomon's daughter, Gracie, released a YouTube video accusing her father of sexually abusing her. Aaron Solomon has not been charged with a crime.
We've had a history of domestic violence, our family, the three of us, Grant, Gracie, and I.
News 2 found court documents from 2014, which state Angelia Solomon continues to make baseless allegations of abuse against Mr. Solomon, sexually and otherwise. The documents also say a temporary restraining order was placed on Angelia, and she was only allowed 6 hours per week to visit with her children. The documents cited Angelia's mental health issues several times.
The mental health issues that Angie Solomon's husband used against her when they were fighting in the custody battle, oddly, may now be her best defense in her murder for trial, a murder for hire trial. And joining me now is someone who knows a lot about this case. Justin Shepherd is a digital journalist who's been following the case from the beginning. You may know his handle, Justin the Nick of Crime. Justin, good to have you. I did not see this twist coming, my friend.
Me either. I was sent the article by about 8 different people, and I was just flabbergasted.
To say the least, the Daily Mail did an interview with Angelina. It's very damning. I mean, the things that they... And they're putting it out now. They didn't put it out before. What's the backstory there?
Well, I haven't seen their particular interview yet, but, you know, back then when she was interviewing with you, Nancy Grace, and everybody who would listen to her, when I was launching my now retired podcast, the second and third episodes were her and Gracie talking about Aaron Solomon, Grant's death, and the accusations that Gracie brought against her own father. And that's kind of the same story that every one of us heard. I would imagine that's what Daily Mail has as well.
They put out a statement, that the newspaper, saying the Daily Mail can now reveal that Angelia Huffines Solomon, 55, said she wanted her ex, quote, gone, end quote, and that he, quote, didn't deserve to be on this earth, end quote, in an interview in 2023 that we are publishing for the first time. This is like, murder for hire is usually a federal crime. So why isn't this one a federal crime?
So I do have a little bit of information that's not quite out there yet, but from what I understand, allegedly, this never took place on the internet. It was never used digitally to find this hitman. It was all done via like a word of mouth thing. So I don't think that we're going to be seeing federal charges. I think it's going to stick to Tennessee and the TBI.
And what about the fact that in Angie and Aaron's custody battle, Aaron accused his wife Angie of having, you know, mental health issues? Is that something that she could now, you know, harness and use in her defense against the murder for hire?
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I'll preface that. But I think that that's going to work out really well in her favor. But at the same time, when you look at like what the Daily Mail said, where she was basically saying what she told this hitman in that affidavit, that's 2 years almost of her. I mean, that's premeditation. That's planning it. That's thinking about it for a long time. So it shows an obsession for sure, maybe a long-term mental illness. But, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. I think that right now that's going to be her best hope.
Man, oh, man, what a saga. Like, talk about a Netflix series. Justin Shepherd, always good to have you on. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'll have you back for sure. Coming up after the break, a lot of 18-year-olds are about to graduate from high school a month from now. So I have no doubt that they have no memory of what happened this very week, the year they were born. For reasons I cannot explain, this week in April has yielded some of the most notorious crimes in our nation's history. It is considered the season of crime. And April 16th, 18 years ago, was no different. I am taking you back there in our True Crime Rewind next. Here's a mystery for you. Why are the history books bursting with horrible things that all happened in April? I don't mean accidents or natural disasters. I mean crimes, big ones, that capture the attention of the nation, if not the world. Like April 16th, 2007, 18 years ago, today. It is the subject of tonight's True Crime Rewind. A 23-year-old student at Virginia Tech grabbed two automatic pistols and unleashed holy hell on his campus. He killed 32 people and shot and wounded another 17 before finally killing himself. Just hours later, the Associated Press did a walkthrough of the bloody campus and showed us just how fast that killer was able to take so many lives.
Joe Sung-wee's final hours before becoming a murderer began here at Harper Hall, inside the suite he shared with several other students who had no idea what was to come.
In the morning when I saw him, there was nothing that I noticed out of the ordinary.
From there, Joe headed out the door toward the building housing what would become his first two victims. West Ambler Johnston Hall, another dorm just a short walk away, and where police say Joe first opened fire. Then it was back to his dorm before one final errand. This is where Joe headed to send out the now infamous package to NBC News, the Blacksburg Post Office on North Main Street, where he filled out the packaging slip and shipped it off to New York. The timestamp, 9:01 a.m. Within 45 minutes, Joe had crossed campus and gone into Norris Hall, the classroom building, and the scene of most of the day's horror. There were no police officers here that morning, no police tape when Joe walked inside. He and 30 others never walked back out.
We should remind you that to date, the shooting at Virginia Tech is considered the third deadliest shooting in U.S. history. Not school shooting, just shooting. And coming up next, a video that stopped me in my tracks. It's another example of just how dangerous it is to be a cop and just how evil some criminals can be. That is a cop in Kansas City, mowed down by the driver of that ATV. A driver who took off and tonight who is still on the loose. I'll tell you how that cop is doing, and I'll have details about the manhunt for the coward who hit him. That's next. Definitely a cop trying to stop a bad guy on a busy street in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's definitely not a fair fight. This happened last Saturday night, a police officer trying to wrestle a reckless driver off his ATV four-wheeler. The unfazed driver just pops a wheelie and mows down that officer, leaving him crumpled in the street, and then he guns it down the road to make his escape. The good news first, even though the officer was and is hurt, he is said to be improving at home and should be back on the job soon, thank God. The bad news, the lunatic who hit him is still out there and on the run. Kansas City PD posted this picture on Instagram, hoping somebody recognizes the guy and does the right thing. It's hard to make out his face, but his ride was a green and black Yamaha Raptor 700. So if you